The class today is going to be a continuation of the lecture that I began last week. And so for the folks who are doing the recording, this is going to be the completion of my last week's class, which is, I have to get the title. Do I need to text you the title, or you got it? Or it's going to be called Mental Calming, Part 2. So it's very cute. Mental Calming, Part 2, Part 2. Did I get that right? Anyway, what happened last week when we started discussing this chapter in the book, Meditation Advice for Beginners by Venerable Boka Rinpoche, when we started reviewing this last week, I was only able to get through part of the text. So I want to see if I can pick up where I left off last week and finish it up. Because I often give talks on topics other than the book that we're studying, I have a free week so I could finish it. So this is good. Anybody who was at the meditation instructor's breakfast yesterday knows that we were supposed to cover four outlines, and we covered. So we just, I do tend to go on. All right, so I'm going to begin with a short prayer in the Tibetan language. If it's a prayer with which you're familiar, it's the four-line refuge prayer. If it's a prayer with which you're familiar, you can join in and sing with me. But if it's a prayer with which you're unfamiliar, no worries. You can join it in your heart and in your mind, dedicating this session to the benefit of all sentient beings. I'll recite it three times. O sanje chudang soji chonam la jang chu pardu dani kyap su chi da ji jin so ji be sunam ki dro la pen chir sanje dru par sho Sanje chudang so chi chonam la jang chu pardu dani kyap su chi da ji jin so ji be sunam ki dro la pen chir sanje dru par sho Sanje chudang so chi chonam la jang chu pardu dani kyap su chi da ji jin so ji be sunam ki dro la pen chir sanje dru par sho O Palden Sawe Lama Rinpoche Tagi Chi Or Pe De Ten Chula Kajin Jinpo Gwane Che Son Te Ku Son Togi Ngo Drup Sao Du So. Okay, thank you. Today we're going to complete this section of the book, Meditation Advice for Beginners. We're covering, in case you're paying attention to the book page numbers, this is pages 65 through 72. The earlier talks have talked about getting ready to meditate and how important it is to take time out of your day and make a space in your day for meditation, and also how important it is to have a place for meditation. I have talked to a lot of people about this before, and in some of the small homes that we have, it's not easy to have a place to meditate. Some people have to use a room that does double duty, such as their library or their bedroom or whatever. But you can still be clever and have a good space in your home to meditate in. I met a woman once who lived in a very small apartment. but she was able to have one corner of her bedroom was her meditation space. And she actually got one of those little screens that you can buy at the, you know, I don't know, you know, like a, some kind of a home store or home decor store. It's just two pieces like this. And she set that up and then had her cushion next to it. And so that was her little privacy area that she could meditate there. So the first chapters of the book deal with things like making the time, making the place, and then the next chapters deal with getting what I call the mental preparation. The physical preparation is the space and the time, but the mental preparation is really what we do with our minds, how we actually make the break between our everyday lives, which can be so busy, and our meditation practice. And sometimes we need to get a little bit of what I might call escape velocity from the busyness of the day. And so how you begin your session of meditation would be to have a place your body in the posture of meditation, which was described in the earlier chapters, by placing your body either in the chair with your feet flat on the floor and then your hands palm downward on your legs. Or if you're sitting on the floor in one of those fancy yoga poses, you know, they call it the lotus pose in yoga, but in Vajrayana Buddhism, they call it the Vajra posture with the left foot on the right thigh and the right foot on the left thigh. So you look like a pretzel, you know. Part of the benefit of being able to do this is that you can then rest your hands on your upturned feet. Well, if your body is like mine and is not cooperating at this time with that kind of posture, then I prefer to use the posture that was made famous by Marpa, the translator, one of the first practitioners of Mahamudra in Tibet. He placed his hands palm downward on the tops of his legs. And he looks sort of majestic like that, sort of royal and majestic and grounded. And so this is how Bokar Rinpoche describes this posture, the posture of Marpa, the translator. So that's my favorite. And then to sit with this posture, with the back straight, chin tucked in, eyes cast down. And then if you can, touch the tip of the tongue behind, on the upper palate behind your front teeth, and just let your face muscles relax. Placing your body in this posture of meditation, you can then form the mental preparation for meditation, which is to think, an untamed mind leads to suffering, and a tamed mind helps us cultivate happiness. Therefore, I'm going to work with my mind in meditation. And I'm going to do this for the benefit of all sentient beings. So that's the physical preparation and the mental preparation. The first breath is a deep breath, breathing deeply and then breathing out, and then allowing the breath to come and go naturally, placing your attention on the breath as it goes in and goes out. You can place your attention on the breath as it goes in and goes out. You can either follow the breath all the way in, follow the breath all the way out, or you can just merely be attentive to the sensation of the breath as it comes and goes from the nostrils. We'll just sit like this for a few moments, observing the breath going in and observing the breath going out. Sometimes as we're watching the breath with our mind, a thought will occur and it will take us either into the past, something that's happened before, or into the future where something may happen. The technique is called touch and let go. You touch the thought lightly with your attention, and you can actually even label it thinking, then you can let go of the thought and return your attention to the breath for a fresh start. We'll practice that for a moment. And at the end of the practice, we mentally dedicate the goodness of the session to all sentient beings. So that's a short description of a session, a very short session of meditation. Now, last week when we talked about the chapter that we're working on now, this page 68, I'm 65 to 72, I've got to make sure I get it right. 65 to 72. Boko Rinpoche says that breath awareness meditation is not for everyone. Not everyone feels a kinship to it, but they might be able to do other forms of meditation. And so in the chapter, he talks about these. And the first of these is to use a small stone. Yeah, I know. Let the record show that I have picked up a cookie. This is a little larger than the standard meditation stone, but you get the idea. And you place it on the table in front of you, not too close, because the smell may interfere with your cookie. But you place the stone in a location where it's easily seen, and you allow your eyes to open and look at it. Now, what's interesting about this technique is that you have to be with the experience of seeing it. You can't go and say, oh, that's a delicious cookie. I mean, that's a delicious stone. Oh, whatever, you know. You can't say it's this or it's that. You can't make a mental comment about what you are seeing. It's pretty. It's ugly. You can't do that because that's not meditation. That's commentary. It's what we do every day, all the time. So the technique of this awareness, using visual awareness, is to place your attention on the object. And let your attention and the object and the experience of seeing be at one. In other words, you're just resting in what you are seeing. Nothing else to do, it's kind of boring. And that's the idea. Now what you'll notice is as you do this, your attention may drift away from the visual object. It may drift into the past, something that happened yesterday, into the future, something that's going to happen tomorrow, or even now, like I could really eat this cookie. But instead, you use the same technique of touch and let go. You touch the distraction. You can even label it thinking, and then let it go and return your attention to the object for a fresh start. And in this way, by returning for a fresh start, what you get is you get the opportunity to start again. You don't have to see your distraction as some sort of mistake or some sort of failure. It's basically part of your learning. You accept the distraction and don't judge yourself for the distraction, but merely return your attention. And if you do this over and over again, you become unafraid of distraction, because some people wait and worry about distraction and they fear it. But the idea is if you see it as a natural part of developing attention and know that you can return your attention again and again, this is very helpful. So this is what we discussed last time. We also said that you could use, instead of a visual object that is solid, you could also imagine an image of the Buddha sitting in front of you in space, made of golden light. You see this image of the Buddha, and you rest your attention on the image of the Buddha. Or if you have difficulty imagining a Buddha, you can place a picture on the table in front of you. And you then place your attention on the picture of the Buddha, or the imagined form of the Buddha made of light. Again, as your attention wanders, you return your attention to the object. And what you're developing is a sense of gentleness. You're developing a sense of gentleness with your attention, a sense of gentleness with the process of meditation. And the diligence of returning again and again and again. Bhoka Rinpoche goes on to talk about these various methods. And he says that once you have worked with a solid object, like a stone or whatever, or which is sometimes called an impure object. It's called impure because it's mundane, as opposed to the image of the Buddha, which is called a pure object because it represents our Buddha nature. So whether you're using the mundane object or the pure object, it doesn't matter. The idea is that once you've worked with them for a while, you'll know which one works best for you. And then you'll be able to use it again and again. And it's very interesting. In some of the meditation texts, they tell you how to place your attention on the object, how to place it. And I didn't bring it into the room with me, but the idea is that you rest your attention on it without comment and just rest in the experience of seeing it. It's pretty simple, and that's what I like about this method. It's very simple, unadorned. But there are other methods you could use as well. You can also use a sound for your meditation. We have the sound of the electronics here. And just place your attention on what you hear. You also could place your attention on a physical sensation, such as the feeling of your body as it touches the cushion or the floor. Just being aware of that sensation of your body meeting the floor. Or the smell of orange rind, or something like lemon or orange that has a strong smell that will remain, and just remaining with the smell. Or as you are eating your lunch, stay with the taste and not comment, oh, it's a good taste, it's a bad taste, just a few minutes like that. And in the meditation text, they say that you can actually just do this for short periods of time. When we were learning this from His Eminence Thaisit Rinpoche, he had us do some recitations first. He had us recite the refuge prayer three times. From now until enlightenment is reached, I take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Through the practice of generosity and other good deeds, may I attain Buddhahood for the sake of all that lives. And you would recite that three times. And then you would say, may all beings be happy and have the causes of happiness. May they be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. And may they have that great happiness, which is freedom from suffering. May they dwell in great equanimity, free from attachment and aversion. Those are called the four immeasurables. And so after reciting the refuge prayer three times and the four immeasurables three times, then you would place the object on the table in front of you, or listen to the sound, or experience the taste or the smell for a short period of time. Just be there with it. And then when you begin to get overly distracted, or your mind becomes tense or restless, then you dedicate the merit of that tiny little session that may only have been 1 or 2 minutes or less even. You dedicate the merit of that tiny session to the benefit of all sentient beings. Through this merit may all obtain omniscience. May it defeat the enemy, wrongdoing, from the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death, from the ocean of samsara, may I free all beings. And then Siddha Rinpoche said, after you've said your dedication prayer, he said, just sit for a moment without thinking of anything. Just let your mind go. And he says, sometimes that little moment where you let your mind go is the best meditation that you've done. Yeah, so I'm going to ask and see if anybody has questions about this. The microphone is corded, so I'll have to repeat the questions. But if anybody has a question about the techniques, they can ask at the microphone. I don't know if you know this, but we record these. And they're available as a podcast. Yes.
Thank you, Lama Kathy. Mm-hmm. I do have a question. I have mostly been taught around here, most commonly we teach the object of meditation as the breath.
Yeah.
And so my meditation, my shamatha practice has been almost exclusively using the breath as the object of my meditation. Mm-hmm. Today you're presenting lots of cool ideas. Mm-hmm. Is it worth switching up to try to see if one works better for me? Is it worth experimenting with? Or since I have several years of experience with one, stick to that?
Right. It depends on you. Mm-hmm. Because for a lot of people, once they find a method that works for them, there's really no need to go looking for other methods. That's really kind of the bottom line. Mm-hmm. However, if you have the time and are willing to deal with the possible repercussions of changing methods, like, oh, it's not going to be easy or whatever, it's fun to try some of the more subtle ones, like visualizing a Buddha, because it's different. Mm-hmm. And you may not always be able to place your attention on the breath. So, so that's kind of what I'm thinking as a change up, but you don't have to do it. Mm-hmm. It's not really necessary to try them all.
Okay.
Because once you've found, because what Kempo Rinpoche has always said, he says, if you try them all, you maybe get confused, but if you find something you really like, just stick with it.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes.
Hey, Lama K. Mm-hmm. Love your teaching today.
Oh, thank you.
Subtle, nuanced, and pithy.
Mm-hmm. It's very unlike me. It's very unlike me.
No, not at all.
I'm in the midst of drinking coffee, which I never do.
Eating your meditation object.
Uh-huh. Yeah, we're done with meditation on this object.
Right, I think so.
Although the smell and the taste are, the taste and the smell are really working for me right now.
If you need a moment, I can.
I'm good.
So I remember some time ago, like, we had talked about this instruction, and I remember, about the thinking, when a thought arises, touching it, letting it go.
Right.
And I had tried that over a couple weeks and reported back to you. And, I remember you saying, I think you're treating your thoughts like an Atari game, like you're shooting, shooting at them and that kind of thing. And you told me to, like, drop it, like, don't do that anymore.
Yeah.
So I guess this is a follow-up question from that from some time ago. But first of all, maybe how, for everyone here and myself, like, so if you're doing that, how do you know you're doing it? And then second of all, is there any, like, technique or anything other than just not doing that form of meditation anymore that could help you to stop treating your thoughts like Atari?
Yeah.
Like an Atari video game.
I really appreciate your asking this question because I also had fallen into that without knowing I was doing it. Where I sort of like lay in wait for thoughts to arise so I could pounce on them. And or I actually met a person who said that he had a hard time meditating because he was always like a little nervous in anticipation that there would be a thought. And so it was almost like he was overly anxious about thoughts, period. Mm-hmm. And I think the first thing to keep in mind is what was said earlier about noticing distraction and then using that as a bridge, that you've noticed the distraction, using that as the bridge itself to come back.
Right.
So it's not like a one-way bridge, that your the distraction will only take you away from your meditation. You can actually use it as a bridge mm-hmm. to return. Mm-hmm. And I think if we can see it like that, that's the first thing that will help us relax the Atari game mm-hmm. mentality of like, right. I got to pounce on this thought.
Right.
Because that gentleness will begin to show mm-hmm. gradually over time. It won't happen instantly, but gradually you'll lose the anxiety about thoughts because you'll see them no longer as an enemy, but as a bridge to return.
Right.
Okay?
Okay.
And then the other thing that you can do is have a contemplation. I'm going to go ahead and give you these, but you can listen to the recording again. Mm-hmm. In some of the texts, they talk about the necessity to cultivate what are called the four conditions for meditation.
Right.
And the first one is to have a mind that is working on renouncing samsara.
Right.
Meaning that you don't want a cookie.
Right.
Okay, which I just had, by the way.
And right.
It's part of my raise your blood sugar at mid-morning thing. So anyway,
right.
At any rate, but you don't want, you know, something from your samsaric, mundane, material life.
Right.
Because you know, you might be thinking, oh, if I meditate really well, people will admire me.
Right.
And, you know, okay, that kind of thing.
Right.
So you have to let go of any mundane concern first. Mm-hmm. That's the first one.
Right.
Have a mind that's let go of samsara. Mm-hmm. The second one is to have and rely upon a teacher, meaning you, in a way, you have to, for the period of learning meditation, give up a little of your self-will mm-hmm. on things, not in a dumb way, but in an intelligent way, mm-hmm. where you allow someone to guide you in meditation and help you when you've made mistakes and that kind of thing. If you have and can rely upon a teacher for that, that's the second condition mm-hmm. for a good meditation. Mm-hmm. Third, I mean, because like a lot of people have good teachers, but they don't follow the advice, or they'll follow the advice, but then they'll forget the advice, you know, so they have mm-hmm. to have a lot going on to really follow something.
Right.
Third is they have to not be burdened by intellectualization. Like saying, oh, well, you know, I can't meditate on this because I believe that, and oh, I read a book once about emptiness, and it said this, mm-hmm. and maybe my meditation should look like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so the idea is to let go of intellectual ideas when you meditate.
Right.
And the fourth one is you should just practice without wanting your meditation to be something.
Right.
You don't want it to be peaceful.
Right.
You don't want it to be thought-free. Mm-hmm. You know, you kind of let go of all of these notions about what meditation right. should be and just let it be what it is.
Right. What do they call it? The celestial child?
Sorry?
Isn't that the celestial child?
Well, the idea is that there are lots of obstacles that can arise right. for people, and one of them is clinging to experience,
right.
which they call it the Mara of the celestial child.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah, if you can work on those, contemplating the four conditions, like do I really want nothing from my meditation?
Right.
Then the Atari game mentality will begin to chill out
okay.
from the background of okay. your meditation.
Okay.
And okay?
Okay, thank you very much.
Oh, no, thanks. Yeah, I'm sorry. You may need to stand up or have somebody help you with a mic stand. Yes.
I just have a small question.
Mm-hmm.
Would it be better to sit in the first position or the second? Because I can mm-hmm. do either one. And
well, you know, I really appreciate you asking this question because some people can sit in that cross leg Vajra position. You know, the complex one that makes you look like a pretzel, and other people can't. So here's what my teacher said. He said, if you can sit in that posture and it doesn't hurt you a lot, that's the best one. Because he said it aligns all of your body so that your body kind of rests in itself, and it's kind of not exactly perfect, but it kind of rests nicely. But if it causes you a lot of pain to do it, he says it's better just to practice the posture. He said, you know what he said? He said, you can practice this Vajra posture while you're watching television so it distracts you from the pain. You know, because the idea is that you're not supposed to be struggling with pain while you meditate. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So the other one is just fine.
Thank you.
That's the one I use. So yeah, thank you. Mm-hmm. Oh, looks like we have a few questions here. Okay, so I'll take these two questions and then we'll return and I'll make one more little presentation part. So please, go ahead.
Yeah, so mm-hmm. you were mentioning the visualization.
I was going to say, is the mic stand falling?
Is it? It's Okay, so you were mentioning the visualization object mm-hmm. in terms of the Buddha for the mm-hmm. Shinai practice. Yeah. And I sort of have some issues with mm-hmm. a certain sense of clarity when I do visualizations for, you know, Yidam practice as well as Shinai. And I was just wondering if you know of any sort of practices I could do to increase the clarity.
Yeah, I can talk about that because I've worked with Kempo Carter Rinpoche on this question and Trongu Rinpoche. I've read his books on this question, but I've actually talked to Kempo Rinpoche. And Kempo Rinpoche, let's start with Trongu Rinpoche because he approaches it first from the intellectual framework and then he talks about the technique and what to do. So intellectually, from the framework of what's happening in the practice of visualization, Trongu Rinpoche says, if you think of your mind as being one thing with eight functions, they talk about the eight consciousnesses. There's the taste consciousness and the nose consciousness and the eye and the ear and the skin consciousness, you know, the five senses that help you to experience the things that your body conveys. So we can put those five on the shelf for the moment. That leaves three more. The sixth one is called the sixth consciousness, and it's actually your mental consciousness. He said the sixth consciousness is what you use to meditate with. Okay? What you use to meditate with. The seventh is the, they call it the afflicted consciousness because it's like, it's a, or the, oh darn it, it's called the seventh consciousness. Anyway, it's the emotion, sometimes called the emotional affliction consciousness, because it's about self-concept and self-clinging. It's the part of you that jumps when you hear a loud sound, because the seventh consciousness is active.
Is it sort of like your ego?
Yeah, it's like you're clinging to it. It's like subtle.
Okay.
It's like subtle, habitual clinging. I know, yeah, it's like a habitual clinging to the ego. And that's one of the last ones to go. And then the eighth consciousness is called the base consciousness. It can also be called the all-basis consciousness, if you're confused, meaning you're seeing everything as solid and real. Or it could be the all-basis wisdom, if you've purified your all of your confusion. So let's just jump back to the sixth consciousness, which is what you're using when you meditate. What Trongu Rinpoche says in his book is that what you imagine that you see in your mind when you visualize something, he said, will never, ever be as clear and sharp as what you can see with your physical eyes. Never. He says it will never be that clear and sharp. So he said the first thing you need to do is relax the expectation that it will be exactly as you can see it with your eyes. That was really helpful for me. He said it will always be moving and indistinct. In another book, he said that that part of the reason that visualizations waver is because our shamatha wavers. Our ability to be attentive comes and goes. In fact, in one of Bokar Rinpoche's books, he says, yeah, sometimes you'll visualize a Buddha and his head will disappear, and then his torso will disappear, or his legs will disappear, and you'll feel a little frustrated. But the idea is not to worry about those momentary changes. Kempo Carter Rinpoche says, the reason you don't worry about the momentary changes, he says, just know that the Buddha, this is in Yidam practice, in mantra practice, know that they're there, that they're actually really present. And that way, he said, if you really work with the idea that they are truly present in front of you, you don't have to just rely on your mental consciousness to create an image that you think should be perfect. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So if you just, that's in mantra practice. Mm-hmm. But for the practice of this Buddha, I think it would be the same. If you use the Buddha, an imagined Buddha, as the image in shamatha, yes, maybe his head will disappear. Yes, maybe his feet will disappear. But the idea is that you have the sense of him being there and then meditate upon him as though he were there and see him all at once. That's kind of what I would do. Now, in mantra practice, they recommend getting pictures and then looking at the pictures and then closing your eyes and then drawing the picture in your mind, and that helps you to remember the places and the gestures and the mudras of the image and things like that. But again, we have to remember, because we're meditating with the mental consciousness, which is inconsistent. It wavers. It naturally wavers until enlightenment. You got, you know. So we got a while. and not to place the unrealistic expectation that it's going to be just as clear. Okay?
Thank you.
Has to be made of light, too. Insubstantial. Because if you substantialize it, you're going in the opposite direction. You know, you can't make it solid. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's part of what mantra practice does, is it dispels this illusion of solidity.
Thank you.
Thank you for asking. That's an excellent question. Okay, and then this will be the last question before the break.
Hello.
Before I return.
Thank you very much, Lama Kathy. Mm-hmm. I'm asking this question because there's a number of people who may be here, and it may be their first time.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as doing a meditation,
mm-hmm.
for trying to start it at home, or maybe
mm-hmm.
at work,
mm-hmm.
would you recommend that as far as starting out, making it a short period,
mm-hmm.
say 5 minutes
mm-hmm.
or 10 minutes,
mm-hmm.
Instead of trying to do a mm-hmm. really long one,
mm-hmm.
and with having a short meditation,
mm-hmm.
To actually have the eyes really looking at an object and mm-hmm. not having your eyes closed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I'm asking for myself mm-hmm. as well as those mm-hmm. who are just starting out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what you've said is fine. I think that the way you've described it is just fine, and then that's a great way to get started, by having short periods of meditation rather than trying to force yourself through longer ones. And also, one of the functions of this technique that Sid Rinpoche taught, where he says that you start with the refuge prayer, three recitations of the four immeasurables, then letting your attention rest on the object, whatever it might be, and then when the mind becomes really torporous or agitated, then dedicating the merit and then letting the mind settle at the end. You could actually take a longer session and break it into, like, you could do 20 minutes if you did like four of these mini sessions in between. But that just depends on you and how your mind works. And I also like what you're saying about the idea of you can actually, whether your eyes are open or closed is going to depend on you. Because some people find that when their eyes are open, that they have more agitation and they need to close them. So what my teacher told me to do was, he said, if you can, just leave them lightly open and take in the general area around you rather than trying to focus on a point. That's the best. So I appreciate that.
Well, and I have a second question.
Oh, dear. Okay.
Oh, no.
Yeah, okay.
No.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah, because I want to make sure we get to the end of the topic.
When do you use the mala?
Mm-hmm. Mala is, the prayer beads are used in, I don't know where mine went. You can be used in two ways. You can use them to count mantra recitations, such as Om Mani Padme Hum, the compassion mantra. You can chant it very softly, like Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum. It's traditional to hold the mala in the left hand, but I know some other people who hold it in the right hand. There's nothing wrong with it. And it is traditional to pull the beads toward you as opposed to push them away from you. And so that's the main way to use the mala, is as an attention device to keep your attention on the practice of the mantra. Some people also who are tactile, you know, some people like things that they feel, they can actually then use it as their meditation timer. They can count off maybe a quarter mala, which is about 3 minutes of meditation, because if they hold it in their hand, in-breath, out-breath, move a bead, in-breath, out-breath, move a bead, in-breath, out-breath, move a bead, they can use that as a timer too.
Well, I wondered about that, how mm-hmm. that might be incorporated in the meditation.
Very good.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Now, to complete this this section, I'm going to read what Bokar Rinpoche, I'm just going to read you directly what he says about dealing with thoughts, which is on page 71. This will cover a little of the material that we've already covered about how to work with your thoughts and how not to use the Atari game mentality on them. And we'll also address a few other things. So I feel that his words are pretty good. In fact, they're like way good. So I'm just going to read them exactly. He says beginners, not being very familiar with the techniques of meditation, often expect to experience a perfectly calm mind, totally free of thoughts. That's why I wanted to read this out loud, you know, that they have this expectation. They fear the coming of thoughts, and when the thoughts arise, they are upset, thinking that they are now unable to meditate. Fearing thoughts, being irritated or disturbed by their appearance, or believing that the absence of thoughts is a good thing in itself, are errors which will lead to useless frustration and feelings of guilt. So hopefully this will help all of you, like including me, whoever felt this way when we meditated. He says the mind of a person who doesn't meditate, the mind of a person who does not meditate, or a beginner, or even an experienced meditator, has thoughts that traverse them. You know, whether you're a beginner or an experienced meditator, everybody experiences thoughts. That's what he's trying to say. But the manner in which they deal with them varies considerably from the beginner to the more experienced person to the person who doesn't meditate at all. Someone who doesn't practice meditation is, in relation to his or her thoughts, similar to a person who has dark glasses or a cover over their eyes facing a distant highway. This blindfolded person is unable to see whether cars are passing or not. Similarly, an ordinary person, while feeling a vague sense of discomfort and inner uneasiness, is not conscious of the flow of thoughts, which nevertheless continue in their mind without interruption. And a lot of people tell me this. They say, I didn't know how much I was thinking until I attempted to meditate. And then they said, I think I have more thoughts now than before. It's not that you actually had more. It's just that now you notice them when they went unnoticed before. And a lot of people tell me when they first start meditating that they feel a little bit victimized by their thoughts, almost like their thoughts are like a large, untamed animal taking them for a walk, you know, on a leash down the street. They actually feel yanked from one place to another by their thoughts, and they feel a little bit vulnerable and victimized by their thoughts. But this is where the technique of meditation comes in handy, because we learn to first gently accept them and then redirect our attention. Now, back to what Bhogkhar Rinpoche says. When we begin to meditate, we discover that we can see and one would like there to be no cars passing. The example of the person with the blindfold, you can now see the cars passing, but you really wish there weren't any cars. If even just one car passes, our expectation is destroyed. A second car is a further disappointment. With a third one, we become irritated, and so on. The naive hope of an empty highway is forever dashed. One is at the same time conscious and unhappy about the succession of vehicles. Each car that passes is seen as a new difficulty. One revolts against an inevitable state of things. And so the idea is that we can form these opinions and thoughts about thoughts. We can think about thoughts and form opinions about thoughts. And so he says, in the same manner, when one sees meditation as a space, as being a space that should be devoid of thoughts, each thought that comes obviously contradicts the preconceived scenario. One is in a situation of almost permanent failure. I'm hoping to release you from this permanent failure. He says, when on the other hand, one has better understood what meditation really is, that is that one returns one's attention over and over again, one observes the thoughts passing, but without rejecting or revolting against them, and without deciding that the mind should be empty of thoughts. One should not expect the absence of thoughts, neither should one fear their presence. The thoughts pass, and one lets them pass. They are neither harmful nor helpful. If thoughts arise in meditation, one lets them naturally pass without being attached to them or condemning them. If thoughts do not arise, one does not find a particular satisfaction in their not arising. Yeah. Even, you can't even, what is it? Pat yourself on the back. Because again, remember the four conditions? The last of the four conditions for good meditation is not to expect your meditation to give you something. Like, oh, a feeling of accomplishment, and so forth. He said, a sane approach to thoughts is a condition for a good meditation. People with a misconception of meditation believe that all thoughts should cease. We cannot, in fact, establish ourselves in a state devoid of thoughts. The fruit of meditation is not the absence of thoughts, but the fact that thoughts come cease to harm us. The idea is that they come and go, and they don't stick. They don't actually harm us by their coming and going, just like the clouds don't harm the sky by coming and going. If we don't grab them, our thoughts, if we don't grab those thoughts, then they don't have the power to harm us. If we don't fixate on them, they don't really have the power. They just pass. And he says, a bad meditation... the fruit of meditation is not the absence of thought, but the fact that they cease to harm us. Once enemies, they become our friends. A bad meditation generally comes from negligence of doing the preliminaries, meaning that we haven't really thought it through, we haven't set our motivation, we haven't given ourselves a time and place, and so forth. Even if these have been completed, it can also come from a misunderstanding of the correct way to place the mind. And he says, ordinary people are perpetually in a state of mental distraction, their mind scattered. Oh, yes, I have a cell phone too. I know how that works. When one meditates, on the other hand, the greatest obstacles come from additional mental productions, which from the commentaries one makes on oneself and on one's preconceptions. Genuine meditation is the avoidance of distraction as well as any additional mental activity. The idea is that you let go of everything and just return again and again. So with that, as I have completed this chapter, I'm wondering if maybe this would be a good time just to meditate just a little bit, so we can kind of put it into practice. Okay. Placing the body in the posture of meditation, whether you're sitting in a chair or sitting on the floor, the back is straight, the hands can be placed palm downward on the legs, the shoulders are straight, the chin can be tucked in slightly, the eyes can be cast downward or be closed gently, the tip of the tongue can touch the upper palate behind the front teeth, and the face then can be relaxed. Forming the mental intention to meditate to benefit others, we then start with one deep breath, breathe out, and then allow the breath to come and go naturally. Placing your attention on the breath, and then redirecting your attention back to the breath for a fresh start when the attention wanders. Because of time, we'll have to stop here. There was a person in the audience who had some additional questions. We have about 5 minutes left. I'd like, if you feel comfortable asking your questions. Not today? Okay, I understand. Yeah, sometimes this happens. I'll meet folks and they'll say, "Oh, I have questions," and it's like, "Okay, we got a microphone, but we'll deal with them after the class." Does anybody else have any other questions? If not, I got some news. Yeah. We're hoping soon to have all of the estimates for our building. So everybody pray. I'm going to ask you to pray this week and pray that the numbers are good. Because we all know that when you're building something or getting ready to build something, what do they always say? Takes longer and costs more. Anyway, but at least that's what I hear. At any rate, but if you could do us a favor this week and send some good energy our way, hopefully the news will be good. I don't know if we're going to get the estimates this week or next week, but hopefully they'll come soon. And so that's the first thing to pray for. Second to let you know that if you are on Facebook, you can go to the KTC Facebook page and see pictures of Lama Tom in India. Lama Tom is in India right now for the Kaju Munlam, and that's why you got a substitute teacher today, because you know I had to work his day off, and so I hope that by the time he comes back here a month from now, he'll be teaching the fourth Sunday in March. I hope by the time he comes back, he'll bring a lot of blessings with him that you can enjoy. And I also wanted to apologize because I did forget to do something that we normally do, and that is this is the Sunday after a Buddhist holiday, and I did completely forget to do prayers. We don't really have enough time to do them now. But this past Friday was Chutro Duchen. The word Duchen is the Tibetan word for great occasion, the great occasion meaning the holiday. And Chu means Dharma, and Trul means activity. So it's a commemoration of the 15 days that the Buddha performed a miracle each day as part of a debate that he was having with non-Buddhist scholars. He decided that the easiest way to win the debate was to be an enlightened being. And so every day for 15 days he accomplished one miracle after the other. And it gave those who were observing him the confidence that his methods of meditation were effective and would benefit them. So, and you could say he won the debate. So these first 15 days of the Lunar New Year are, you could say, powerful days for practice. And so I'd like to thank all of you for doing your practice the last few days and to invite you to keep going. So far, my promise for this year was to try to be more attentive to my shrine and like dust it a little more often, and you know, make sure that I make offerings a little more often. And I can, you know, knock on wood, it's not going too badly. But I hope to keep up the good work, and I hope that all of you can continue doing your practice and doing things that help your mind. And so forth. I will also tell you that I had a daydream this morning while I was supposed to be meditating. I just want to share it with you. I had a daydream about Sunday morning in our new place. I just had a daydream about it. As I was driving in, my daydream was that we have two classrooms in the lower level. One of them is a library and the other is a classroom. And that in the classroom, people are learning to meditate. It's 10 o'clock, right? People are meditating and learning to meditate in the one room. And in the other room, they're chanting Chenrezig or Medicine Buddha. I like that. That's my thinking. Or meanwhile, over in the coffee room, people are having tea or coffee and relaxing and discussing Dharma. And then upstairs, everybody's meditating. So that's my daydream. I hope that that this comes to pass in some form or other for us in the not too distant future. So again, just keep those prayers coming. I really, really thank you and appreciate that. Let's sit quietly and dedicate the merit of this session. We dedicate the merit of this session to all suffering beings. May all beings everywhere be free from suffering, come to happiness, and then to Buddhahood. and coming to Buddhahood, may they emanate in all directions and benefit sentient beings endlessly. We dedicate the goodness with this thought in mind. Thanks, everybody. Have a good week. I'm off next week, next Sunday, but I'll be back the Sunday after. So,
thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you.